Tuesday, review session on the 26th of October. All right. Okay. And if you want me to hear, we're a small group, you really could come down close and be friendly, because the germs are all down here, right? All the viruses. Great, thank you.
Do you think we could call those sample essay questions?
I'm sorry?
Do you think we could call those sample
essays? The sample essay questions? Sure. What are they?
Okay, the first one is, with what does the baby begin intellectual development?
Good question. With what does a baby begin intellectual development? What do you think?
The ability to understand the kind of languages, if you learn different languages.
Okay, the ability to learn different languages. Yeah, there are a number of sort of built-in distinctions that they can make. What about equipment, basic equipment? For babies starting off. Or equipment that is going to help with intellectual development. You've got the brain, which is pre-wired to do some things. And then in addition to that, right, I was thinking the blocks would be a good thing to have there as equipment for them, but what equipment do they bring? What equipment does the baby bring? Reflexes? Yeah. And here it is. Sensory capacities, able to hear, to see, to feel. And what other kinds of equipment? Louder. Oh, okay. So you have the sensory abilities, you have the motor skills or the potential to develop those. In other words, the baby comes prepared to experience the world that it has, the world it's coming into. And then it has a brain that's going to recognize repeated actions. So it's going to recognize the familiar and make those into schemas or patterns. So it has the basic equipment. It has some other characteristics that are going to help in intellectual development, because it has all those characteristics that make it attractive to adults and caregivers. So it's going to get experience to the extent that they are responsive to it. And as the baby responds to the caregivers and you build up a transaction, then you build up the potential to extend those schemes and to apply them in different ways. So it's biology says, I'm ready, and then that provides it the basic foundation that it needs to experience and to make sense out of that experience, which becomes the cognitive or intellectual development. And it has its interpersonal characteristics, or its smiliness and its cuddliness and its responsiveness and its tendency to goo and do things like that attract people to have transactions with it, and that enhances its experience. An amazing little machine. And when you get one, the manual that comes with it will tell you all that. Gee, look at all these features of your new baby. One of the nice things about the internet, you can download the manual for your new baby. I haven't tried doing it, but it's pretty. Great possibility. There's a website. Yes. What is gained and what is lost? At different points, why would that be important? What's an example of something, say, at two? What? Any? Mm-hmm. Okay. So, along the way, you lose some of the potential as you gain more power, as some things become kind of solidified, you lose some of the options. So, after a baby starts hearing and trying to reproduce the sounds of the language that it's hearing, that it's exposed to, it loses some of the potential to distinguish the sounds in other languages that it's not using. At puberty, again, language is involved because you have a reduction in the capacity to learn to produce languages, the sounds of languages, without to speak them natively. And after puberty, then languages are learned by translation rather than what we call natural language learning. So you can't just walk into a room and start picking up the language after adolescence because you think too much and you want to find the connections between what you already know and what you're being exposed to, so you start translating, and that slows the whole process down. It's a fascinating loss. At the same time, you're gaining the ability to think much more complexly about things, but it's costing on the other end. Other examples where that might be important? Losing the ability to learn things that are
fluid.
Okay. So some of the skills, and this was the original question, I think, now that I'm getting tuned into your question. It's just, I have to ramble around it for a while. What is gained and what is lost across adulthood? And some of these skills decline as we get older, and some don't. Intellectual performance, yeah. I'm sorry. The ones that decline for most of us we call fluid, and the ones that don't we call crystallized. It's just they don't decline because they're somehow. If you think about the difference between them, and it's the general difference that you should know, that those things that are based on the speed of processing, those slow down and we get less good at them. But those things that are based on experience and information that we've gained over a lifetime, those tend to continue to increase as we keep accumulating more experience. So things like performances like coding tasks where you have random nonsense patterns and you have to assign numbers to them and they're timed, that tends to slow down partly because you don't practice it and partly because you don't care. It's not very important to be able to do that, and partly just because the equipment is slowing down. Visual processing and motor skills are slowing down. So most of the ones that are based on most of the fluid skills, the ones that decline, the decline is reflecting biological slowing down. and the ones that don't decline are not as affected by biological slowing down because it's not based on that. That's what you were asking about? No? Okay. Have we gotten there yet? Okay. Okay. What's gained and what's lost?
Yeah, I don't know. It's on page 579.
Oh, okay. Good. Give us a reference. 579. We must be into adulthood there. Talia's looking. Okay, we're looking at 579 in the text. Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
No, that's my other question.
That's your other question.
Okay.
All right. Okay, you want to go to that one or? Sure. Okay, that's on 579. Yeah. Age differentiated and age integrated are referring to the concept of life structure. And that's not a huge particular concept in this particular unit. We are going to come back to that notion about how you create a structure to a life, but it's an interesting section, but it's not particularly central to my thinking about cognitive development. So it's in the use of intellectual skills and the relationship of work and leisure choices and the kinds of relationships that you have and how those help structure your life. But we will come back to that notion in the next unit, but I won't ask about it this time. And the way I'll ask about it is a little general, but I'll just give you a preview of that. The question that I'm likely to ask is, what's the relationship between the kind of work that you do and the way your life gets structured? Now, there are other places in the text where the question about the kind of work you do is important, and we didn't spend time on class in it, but it is an important concept. As you look at the experiences that help people keep their intellectual performance, it's connected to the notion of crystallized intelligence. The people who retain their intellectual skills best have particular kinds of experiences, and those are experiences that typically require intellectual activity, or they, because they're interested and curious, they continue to expose themselves and engage themselves in intellectually demanding experiences. And the evidence is getting stronger and stronger and stronger that the brain is a muscle, and if you keep exercising it, it's not really a muscle, but it's an organ that needs to be exercised. And the skills that you don't use, the processes that you don't practice, you forget. You don't use them. So it's use it or lose it is the basic point. And if you look at the Seattle Longitudinal Study, for example, particularly, they draw conclusions about which people are likely to maintain their intellectual skills into old age best. And they're people who are engaged in complex activities. They're people who are in relationships regularly with people who stretch them and challenge their thinking. And they engage in novel tasks. They learn new things regularly. And in that sense, if you're not using it, you are losing. But you can continue to gain in those areas that you constantly practice. And now you see occasionally, it's fun to see AARP and the American Gerontological Society and other groups coming out with lists of things to do to keep your mind, literally to keep your mind is what they're saying. It staves off dementia. It even seems to delay Alzheimer's, even for people who are genetically predisposed to Alzheimer's, that intellectual activity, starting in childhood and adolescence, if you maintain it, it lets you keep your intellectual skills longer. But you can buy books now on Mind Olympics. Give them to your parents for holidays this year. They'll appreciate it. But I like the example that my mother at 93 does the crossword puzzle in ink. And beginning of the free press puzzle, like most of them, is pretty easy on Monday. She says she can do it with one eye. And by Saturday, it's really difficult. They get much more difficult. And she starts asking me for words, computer-related things, modern culture, TV, stuff that she doesn't pay any attention to. I don't either, but we struggle through. I start helping her a little bit about Wednesday. And Saturday, we sometimes both struggle to finish the crossword puzzle. But I'm noticing that at 93, she's continuing to increase her vocabulary. I'll see something coming up as a clue that she didn't know last year, but because it's been used, she's learned it. And she may not know what it actually refers to, particularly if it's a technology term, but she recognizes, well, if this is the clue, that's the word. And she keeps learning those things. And I haven't seen that she's lost any of her vocabulary over the years. She still knows all those weird African antelopes and their names and volcanoes in Borneo and just all this kind of trivial stuff. But she uses it every day. And so you gain in those areas where you keep practicing, and you lose, again, in those areas that you don't exercise. And that relates to the work you do, because some people's work doesn't require them to think or learn anything new. And some people retire and they don't have a new activity ever again. And they're the ones who are going to go downhill. So when they tell you to have hobbies, what they really mean is intellectually challenging hobbies, where you're going to have to learn something new, solve new problems, relate to people who don't just sit and say, yes, Mom, no, but people who will actually engage you in a discussion. And that's really important. The question, if I understand it, is what she's doing in old age, learning new definitions, really not understanding the content of them, but understanding the connection to the clue, is that sort of what toddlers are doing? That's a very nice connection. It's a very nice connection, because toddlers will learn the associations between things, and they'll be able to use words often in a context without really understanding what they mean. Sometimes to our embarrassment, you know, because they're using words that they've heard us say in similar situations. Kid drops something, breaks something, and out comes an expletive that the kid doesn't have any idea what it means, but there it is, because that's what he or she has associated. So yeah, it's that same kind of associative process that's common across all of life. So it's the way the brain works. It doesn't mean she's reverted to the toddler level, because she still has her formal operational thinking. It's also fun to watch her. I'm really having a lot of fun since she moved here, and I'm spending time almost every day with her. Just watching her learn new things and change her ideas and change her thinking and challenge herself. There's something going on in the senior center where she lives, the senior housing. It's independent living, but somebody proposed a change in the way they govern themselves, and she doesn't like new things typically, but she began to realize that people, if they're proposing a change, they must have some reason for that. So she went out of her way to find out what the reason was and sought out the information, and eventually decided to support the change. And I was very impressed by that, because when she started off, it was, we don't need that. But as she learned about it, she was able to, okay, we do need it, so I can support that. Or it wasn't even that she needed it. Other people needed it, so she would vote for it. And I just hope I can keep that kind of open-mindedness when I...
How do the thinking of operational children and formal operations add up?
Okay, the difference between concrete operational thinking and formal operational thinking. And I had a page up there on the website. Would it help if I put that up? I can do that, I think. And what I had put up mostly was what we expect adolescents and adults to be able to do. So if you look at what formal operations lets us do, and look at how you would approach things if you didn't have the formal operational skill, then you get it to what concrete operational kids might do. You remember what some of those were? Having more than one answer for something, be right. Comparing two separate or different systems, putting them together, and keeping them straight, that's an interesting challenge. It's here, I know.
It's adolescents that don't have the formal operation.
It's adolescents who do.
I thought it was that they needed the concrete one answer.
No, that's concrete operational.
Oh, okay.
Elementary school kids. Okay. I'm sorry?
Is this
an
online?
It should be.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I used it yesterday, the beginning of class. That's what we expect. And those are the kinds of performance changes when you add formal operational reasoning, the ability to deal with those abstract systems. But we didn't really talk about what the concrete operational child can do, but it's the concrete operational child, the elementary school age kid, is becoming much more logical, but is not able to deal with things where you have a set of relationships that aren't concrete. They're not out there where you can see them. They're things that you're thinking about, which is what we mean by abstract in this context. That you're thinking about them, they exist in your head, but the concrete operational child doesn't keep those things straight in the process of comparing two of them. So in the analogies, for example, the concrete operational kid can understand the relationships between the two concepts on each side, but can't compare them. That's the abstract comparison, because those relationships exist in the kid's head, and the comparison has to happen in the kid's head. And they're different things, they're different content. Ed? Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. That's why with concrete operational kids, with elementary school kids, if we want to try to teach them something that we can't actually put there, we have to have the pictures. We have to do simulations of some sort. There has to be something for the kid to process, some content. I can't just do it in words. It's just not going to work. So they have to have the concrete experience there. And the formal operational kid can take a hypothetical situation that I describe in words and think about it. Amy?
So it's hypothetical that you watch me with you in your head, or understanding that after finding one answer, there might be
That's the scientific thinking, and it means that you're developing a hypothesis, which all kids can do. You know, and a hypothesis is, the toddler version or the infant version, got one, Ed? You have to understand. Ed has a how old now?
7 months old.
7 months old. Do you watch him?
Yes.
Develop hypotheses. Yeah. And a hypothesis is just a possibility, and what you see with infants like that is there is a possibility of getting out of this chair. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to test it, and they use trial and error to test it. I was thinking of Sam, who's a year and a few months. You can watch, you should watch the wheels turn in his head. About what's going to happen if he pushes something off the tray of his high chair. And you see him do it. It's just, okay. And there it goes. And then you put it back, and he looks at you, and you can hear the hypothesis. The hypothesis is, if I push this, he's going to put it back up there. So they're sensory motor hypotheses, and they're trial and error, and they're doing things. What's different about scientific reasoning is that you understand that when you test a hypothesis, you have to keep everything else constant. You can't go changing four or five things, or even two or three things, in an experiment. If your hypothesis is about how hard you push something, you have to have everything else be the same so that you can vary how hard you push it to see if there's a different result. And that's what scientific reasoning means, that you can develop your hypothesis, but then you isolate the variables and you test them systematically, one by one. You don't put chemical A, 1 and 2, in a beaker and 3 and 4 in another one. Or all four of them together to test each one. You have to do them systematically. And you have to make your comparisons just one at a time, one variable at a time. Would I focus on it?
Sure.
I would be more likely to ask a question about the characteristics of adolescent thought, or how it differs. That's a kind of nice study question for me. What do you expect adolescents to be able to do as they acquire formal operational thinking. And there are others. There's a whole set of things. Piaget's theory is so rare, is not his theory, his research is so rich that he's developed dozens of demonstrations of different kinds of skills. And the task as you become a teacher, for example, or as you become a psychologist, is to see what's common across those tasks and how they're related. So there are too many of them to present and have you try to make sense out of. So the basic message here is that the approach to a particular task is different at each of the stages. And there are some common themes. The sensory motor approach is always sensory motor. And when you become concrete operational, it's much more logical, but it's still connected to the content. And when you become an adolescent and adult, you're able to think about the whole system and compare things based on the pattern or the form rather than the specific content. You can compare the Planned Parenthood example with the chemical example and see that they have similar patterns, even though the content of those is completely different.
Can you go through how the thinking changes across the lifespan, like the process, the how?
The easy answer to that question, no, I'm too tired to do that. How thinking changes across the entire lifespan. How would you want to approach that question if I were so foolish as to ask a question that broad? What would you want to include in that? Okay, there's a nice general statement. Early on, you're taking in knowledge and you're across childhood and adolescence acquiring new ways of processing it. And as you get older, you may not be taking it in as well, but you may be doing different things with it or using it in different ways or using it more efficiently. One of the things we expect to see, and I didn't say this, but the text describes the tendency for people to be able to be more efficient in some kinds of learning because they're able to see the larger task. And I call it psyching out the professor. You see that when students start figuring out how to ace courses because they have figured out by the time they're juniors or seniors how to figure out what the professor wants and what the professor is hung up about and what the professor is really pushing. And they get much better at not spending a lot of time on the things that aren't as important because they're reading the professor. They're reading the course and the syllabus and taking their cues from the professor. It's one of the reasons that older students, when they come back to school, do so well. They always fear they're going to not be able to keep up with you, but they do, because they're so much more efficient in their learning. They are very much better at saying, that's not important, that's not important, that's not important. This is key, this is key, this is key. But they do that on the basis of years of learning things and understanding the world from a much more complex, broader standpoint than 18 and 19-year-olds do. Right? Ed's our resident expert on adulthood. So I guess if I were going to expand on that essay, if I asked something that broad, I would start thinking about the whole lifespan, and I would describe a little bit about Piaget's stages, because the what we're learning, what we're taking in, how we're processing it is different in some predictable ways. And then I would talk about the continued ability to learn new things, but the way our thinking changes is much less driven by biological maturation in adulthood than it is in childhood. Think about the connection between the brain in childhood and adolescence. Piaget is making the argument that the switch to the next, the addition of the next skill is based on brain development. And after you're in your 20s, you're not going to see that brain development until you get toward the end and the brain starts to decline. So the nature of the biological connection changes. It's a very broad question, and I wouldn't ask it in this class. But I might ask part of it. So it's fair game as a more specific question. Other... How about Baltus? Yep. Good old Paul Baltus. B-A-L-T-E-S. Baltus is one of the principal investigators in the Seattle Longitudinal Study of Development. And that's been our major source of understanding about intellectual development in adulthood, study that's been going on now for 40 or 50 years. So you really should know about that study, and particularly from that study, some of the important things they've described are the life circumstances that lead to people maintaining their intellectual skills, and I just talked about those a few minutes ago. Having challenging work, engaging in complex activities, learning new things, hanging out with people who are intellectually competent and will engage in complex conversations with you. Maintaining good health. People who have chronic illnesses tend to decline in their thinking. There are famous exceptions to that, so it's not grounds for writing yourself off if you develop a chronic illness. You look at somebody like Stephen Hawking, the astrophysicist. His body is totally wasted, and he has to have personal care attendant all the time. In fact, he had a problem last year? Yeah. His caretaker left him out in the sun and he got sunburned and fired the caretaker, but he is unable to move himself. He has two different conditions, and I think one of them is ALS. I think he has, I think he's one of the longest living people with ALS. He's had it for years and years and years, but he still writes books. Although he can't type them, and his speech is very labored, he's still out there writing about what do we mean by time, and how are time and space related in the universe. So his brain is staying very active. So he's a very interesting exception. But many of us, when we, as we deteriorate, particularly if we have chronic illnesses, we begin to lose it. And the Seattle Longitudinal Study has followed people until they die, and they're continuing to follow some of the original sample who are now in their 80s. They've also got the clearest data about which kinds of skills change and which ones tend to not change, or which ones increase and which ones decrease. And Baltus has been around doing research since I was in college. He's still out there doing it. He's a professor in Germany, but he does research in the United States. He's been at Penn State, West Virginia. Liz? What's an example? Okay, and the question is the relationship between the biological and the cognitive development, and the underlying connection of the brain and its maturation is the easiest one to refer to. Piaget says, as your brain develops, you develop new cognitive skills. And so that one's fairly simple. Brain maturation is necessary for the development of new levels of cognitive skill. You also have later in life, particularly later in life, although it can happen at any time, a sick brain, a brain that's declining, leads to decline in cognitive skills. Okay. That
In certain problems, doesn't that take a while for people to notice because your brain changes, so you don't really lose any, just rotates where stuff is? According to, like, this part of your brain will be dying, but it'll move that over.
In some cases, the observation is that in some cases you may not notice that because you're adapting to the changes in the brain. And if you continue to challenge yourself, the brain is plastic enough that some functions get taken over by other areas of the brain. But if you're not getting enough oxygen generally, for example, which is a problem in old age because people stop breathing as heavily and their arteries begin to harden and clog up, they don't get enough oxygen in their brain, and then you see typically general cognitive decline. But anytime we're talking about a relationship in this course, there is also the implication that you need to look at the other direction. Huh. And that one is a little more difficult, in part because we haven't talked about it. So there's a bit of a challenge there. If I move to a new cognitive level, if I learn something, if I become smarter, what effect is that going to have on my biology? Okay, that's part of the same process. It's a connection that whenever I'm learning something, there are new connections being made.
You change your habits, which might change your physical health because you know what's good and bad for you.
Okay, so at some point I actually begin to understand the long-term consequences of some of my behavior, and as I understand it, I begin to worry about it, and then I actually might change it, and that might affect my biology. So I stop smoking. And that changes my biology. I stop smoking because I begin to be able to see and anticipate the long-term consequences of that. And as I have more experience, as I've been smoking, for example, and I can do the personal case in this case, the personal experience of smoking and not seeing the effects of that, which is common. None of you smoke, but some of your classmates do. And they don't see the consequences of that. And so they keep on smoking, and tobacco is extremely addictive. It's very difficult to quit. But at some point, as you get smarter, you get more information, and you begin to recognize the change that's taking place, and you decide to quit. And my experience is that almost nobody quits until they get a real sense of their own personal mortality and how it's affecting their performance. In my case, it was not being able to keep up with an 8-year-old, my own 8-year-old. And got to quit this stuff. So I did, having tried it many times before. So one could argue that remember Shy? Stages of adult development. And acquisition was first. And then he says there's an intellectual stage of responsibility. It's the responsibility stage when people quit smoking. And that affects their health. So my sense of responsibility for myself and for my children led me to change my habit. Okay. So that would be one way that you could connect the cognitive to the biological. There are a couple of other ways too. If you think about some of the material in the book talking about who lives longest, people who are engaged in cognitive activity not only maintain their intellectual skills longer, they live longer. The text doesn't say it, but I'll illustrate that with the group, the professional group, is the occupational group in the United States that has the longest average lifespan. I'm asking you to guess. What? Stockbrokers? No, actually they have because of high stress. Stockbrokers have a much shorter life than professors. What? Not necessarily. No. Professors. No, professors. For several reasons. One is the continued use of cognitive skills, and one is access to healthcare in the United States. You know, our contracts come along with pretty good healthcare. And one would argue the low stress. This is not a stressful job. We're among the lowest stress. We get to hang out with young people all the time. He says young. On the other hand, our secretaries are among the highest stress group. Don't tell my secretary that. They're not supposed to know that. But we transfer all of our stress to them or to you. You absorb all my stress. I don't have to sweat, right? I don't remember the details of that chart. I should go back and look at it. Yeah, it'd be interesting. Remind me to do that. Some of us like to argue that our superior intelligence enables us to see the consequences of our actions. We also tend not to be risk takers in general. We don't typically get killed in car accidents from driving too fast. It's a low probability cause of death for us. We're just so conservative and I'm trying to think of non-pejorative terms to call myself, but pejorative means insulting. I'm trying to think of nice ways to say we're really dull and we live ordered lives and we don't do risky things like skydiving and all those things. So anyway, that would be another potential connection between cognitive skill and biology. Other thoughts about that connection? It is an important connection, and I haven't emphasized it quite enough in lecture how we put those two together, but you'll see through the text connections. Another one that people are commonly drawn to is the fact that in adolescence, suicide becomes a major problem. And depression is much more common among adolescents. And risk-taking behaviors in general, risky behaviors, smoking, drinking, use of drugs. And all of those have a component in them of being based on the use of formal operational skills. That the adolescent's ability to look at hypothetical situations may feed participation in more risky activities because you see the potential for fun or the potential for a thrill or because you're cleverer at thinking of ways to engage in the activity without your parents catching you. You're not as dependent on your parents. So adolescents get themselves in situations where their physical health is at risk. And that may be, I'd suggest thinking about it as possibly dependent on or the consequence of being able to think much more cleverly. I think the depression and particularly the suicide is because, and we'll talk about this in the next unit, but I think the ability to think about hypothetical situations and to think long term gives adolescents the potential for hypothesizing that their current situation, instead of just being now, may last forever. And if you think about being a pubescent kid or having just been dumped by your first girlfriend, hard, since adolescents tend not to be kind in dumping each other, or beginning to recognize your parents' faults and your own, because you're using these new intellectual skills, you think about all of that stuff happening to you and can hypothesize, you know, if life is going to be like this, then adulthood is going to suck. And that's pretty depressing. And if your problems are very serious, you can begin to think about how there are more options for getting out of the situation. And one is terminating yourself. So I think the cognitive skills that come along with formal operations have a huge variety of consequences, both cognitively and or biologically and interpersonally. and those are reflected in health and mental health. When adolescents or adults think about how nice it was to be a child and not have to worry about things, not understand how the world worked, that's a real serious thing. You know, that children don't have to worry about the world in ways that adults and adolescents do. And it can be pretty discouraging if you're burdened. You're just discovering that and you're burdened by it and can't see the possibility of really making a difference, then you can get pretty discouraged. And that can lead to self-destructive choices. Other issues? Questions? You started us off with the sample essay questions. Have we covered any more than the first one of those? We actually have? Wow.
Actions and
what happens What was the context for the word? But yes, I mean the latter.
How are a child's actions important to the child's intellectual development?
Right. The question is, the essay question is, how are children's actions important in their intellectual development? We start off with the sensory motor action. And what we develop schemes about are sensory motor actions. So, in a constructivist view, in Piaget's view, it's your action in the world that is giving you the foundational schemes that you're going to then build on. And if you're not active in the world, if you're not making things happen and exploring them and pushing things off your high chair, you're not going to understand them. You're not going to build those intellectual skills. Which is very interesting when you think about kids who cannot move themselves. Then you have to think about how else are they going to develop intellectual schemes. And if you look at what we do for kids who don't have mobility, we move them and we engage them. If we're being successful with them, we put them through actions. We do the movement with them. We move their arms, we move their legs, and we make things happen that they can participate in. And that's a really important part of the cognitive development of kids who have limited mobility. And when that doesn't happen, you see kids not developing cognitively to the degree that you know they might if they were getting lots of sensory motor stimulation. This is new. I'll just throw it in as an example. A number of years ago, we began to really understand the effects of malnutrition on cognitive development. And our fundamental assumption about that, without much evidence, was that during early childhood, malnutrition slows brain development. And so people began to worry when there were famines in the world, if kids weren't getting enough to eat, particularly not enough protein, it was going to stunt their growth, but also whether there were going to be cognitive deficits because their brains weren't going to grow enough. And there was a brilliant study that started off with a letter by a researcher at Cornell who pointed out that malnutrition has to be pretty severe to stunt brain growth. That's the last thing. You'll waste away, but your brain will keep developing because that's the way the body works. It knows you have to have a brain. So to actually stunt brain growth takes a tremendous amount of malnutrition. And this researcher pointed out that the cognitive development problems of malnourished kids probably come not from the effects on their brain growth, but on their ability to engage adults in activity and their ability to engage in action in the world. That when you're too hungry, you become lethargic. That's one of the characteristics of malnutrition. You stop moving, you stop exploring, curiosity goes down the tubes, and you get cranky. You may have noticed if you start missing meals, you get cranky and whiny and fussy, and adults don't want to play with you when you're doing that. But he pointed out that, in fact, what we need to do with kids who are malnourished is to make sure that we keep them active in the world. And he was using as his sample not kids who were not getting enough food, but kids who, because of metabolic disorders, were not able to process that food. And he was looking at kids who had metabolic disorders, genetic metabolic disorders, and pointing out that their behavior was keeping them from having the behavior that was resultant from their malnutrition, which in their case wasn't because they didn't have enough to eat, because they just weren't getting enough. That was keeping them from having the experience in the world that's necessary for cognitive development. And he pointed out that when middle-class parents have kids like this, they know they have to bring the experience to the kid. And that's what the remediation is about. You help the kid have the experience, even if the kid can't initiate it, him or herself, because we know that the experience is what's important. Action. Activity. Active. And in toddlerhood and infancy, that means physically active, and we need to continue that, experiencing new things. And I've said a couple of times that I want to emphasize that we add skills, we don't lose them. We continue to learn things sensory-motorily, and some things we can't understand until we get the sensory-motor experience. One of my personal examples of that is learning to sail as an adult. I hadn't sailed as a child. We didn't have water where I grew up, and certainly no sailboats. And when I started to sail as an adult, I read the books, I went out with people, I heard the explanations, and the abstract principle of sailing in a sloop-rigged boat escaped me. I could read the words, and they didn't make any sense, because a sail is a wing. And it made absolutely no sense to me that a boat is falling forward through the air. It made no sense to me that a boat could sail faster into the wind than away from it. That's totally counterintuitive. It's not true for square-rigged sails, but for a sloop-rigged, triangular sails sail faster into the wind. And it took me about 4 years of sailing and not being able to go where I wanted to go before I finally got it. And where I got it was in the seat of my pants, literally. Literally. It's a sensory motor experience of feeling the boat literally in the seat of your pants, feeling the wind on your face, being able to play with the sail, act on the sail, and direct the leading edge of the sail into the wind, and feeling what that does to the boat. And after about 4 years of puttering around in Burlington Bay in front of the Ethan Allen and aggravating the captain of the ferry and not being able to get back from wherever I had gotten to because I didn't understand how the boat sailed, And I was reading the books, and they just didn't make any sense to me. And I finally got it as a sensory motor experience and developed the sensory motor schemas that were necessary for understanding that all that stuff about the wing. And then I got it. And the abstract stuff now makes perfectly good sense to me because my body understands it. And it was a wonderful experience for me. And several years ago, I took a friend out sailing, and she had a 9-year-old, 10-year-old foster daughter that she wanted to take sailing. And so we took her out. It's really funny because I give people the tiller. So ask a 10-year-old kid if she wants to take over the tiller, move over, let her sail it. You know, nice steady wind, good waves. You know, she's not going to ruin the boat. She's not going to hurt it or tip us over or any of those things. It's a big enough boat. So she was playing, and I was fascinated by watching her play. She'd never been in a sailboat before. And she started playing with the tiller and the wind. And I just let her do it. You know, she'd come through the wind, sail would luff, flap, 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 flap. And the foster mother friend of mine would say, don't do that, you know, and just constantly on her. I said, quit, shut up. She's doing exactly what she needs to learn how the boat operates. And she's not going to hurt anything. And she played. And in an hour, she had it all figured out. And then she started asking me questions. What happens if we pull this in? What happens if we go this way? And they were concrete operational hypotheses. She wasn't quite ready to test them. She wasn't formal operational. But it took her an hour to get what it took me 4 years to get, because she was much closer to her sensory motor skills, and I let her do it. And she was just having a ball, learning how the boat worked. And then she worked on putting it into words and testing it out. So the difference is that when you're a formal operational learner, you don't always have to go back to the sensory motor experience fresh. The formal operational learner can start saying, okay, if I don't understand this, what kind of experience do I need to build my understanding on? So the sensory motor experience may be where you come, but you can get there faster because you recognize that you need the sensory motor experience. But that's because you can think about how you think and how you learn. I was just pretty slow about it. The example won't be on the exam, but maybe it'll help. Other questions? Things you're worried about? Did I warn you about that?
Yeah.
The first day? Yeah. It is. Cognitive development is much more difficult conceptually than biological development. There's absolutely no question about that. It's a bigger stretch. You have a lot more background and knowledge about biological development. There's very little new there for you. But when you start thinking about schemes and operations and how you think, most of us don't have much experience. And it's harder stuff. But almost everybody's in the same boat, if that's any consolation.
Did you think this exam was a lot more difficult? Or, if you have a general grasp of the material, can you do well?
No, I would not say this exam is a lot more difficult. I would say where it's difficult in different ways, and some parts of it are probably easier. in general, you have much better knowledge about how I ask questions and what we're looking for in the way of depth on the essays, so that makes it easier. The content itself is a little more difficult. We're going to grade a little easier on the essays, I think, and they're worth more points, worth more, so there's more potential points on them. Yeah. You know, the interesting thing is that the average on each of the first two exams is just almost the same most years. And yeah, so you know, some people improve, some people don't. People who did the writing exercise tend to do better. Okay. What? I actually need to answer that question. I need to go and do the statistics on that. It's one of my haven't gotten to yet. But yeah, I don't know how big a spread it is, but I'm confident in the statement. But I can't tell you whether it's 5 points or six or eight. It's online. The syllabus is online, and I do have more in the office if you want one.
Okay.
Have a great evening.